Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons have gone on a hunger strike, and a leader of the hunger strike has been placed in solitary confinement. Prisoner hunger strikes have also had a history in the United States. What are the similarities between U.S. and Israeli prisons? What are the demands of the Palestinian prisoners, and do they have any similarity to demands from U.S. prisoners? How does the prisoner population in both countries reflect political struggles? Our guest is Hank Jones of the San Francisco 8. Hank has spent time in U.S. prisons, and he was also part of a delegation that traveled to Palestine. And we continue our Know Your Rights series, focus on immigration, today on sanctuary cities. We speak with Emily Robinson, clinical attorney with Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic, a project of Loyola Law School. Also, our Africa Rising series. In the lead up to African Liberation Day, we discuss the emerging movement Africa Rising, the history and significance of Gori Island, as well as the role of people of African descent in the diaspora in the growing movement for change in the continent of Africa. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The U.S. Supreme Court blocked Arkansas officials from carrying out their first of a series of planned double executions before the end of the month. The court's decision late Monday came minutes before Don Davis was to die. It capped a chaotic day of legal wrangling to clear the obstacles Arkansas faced to carry out its first execution since 2005. Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge says there are five scheduled executions remaining and no legal obstacles to carrying them out, although she expects lawyers for the inmates to file fresh court challenges. The next two are scheduled for Thursday. Republicans are hoping to prevent a major Democratic upset in a Georgia congressional district special election to replace Republican Tom Price. Donald Trump appointed Price to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Today's primary features 18 candidates. Republicans concede that 30-year-old Democrat John Ossoff, a former congressional aide and filmmaker, will come in first. They're hoping he fails to score a simple majority. If he doesn't, Ossoff and the top Republican vote-getter would meet in a June 20th runoff. The race is being billed as a referendum on Donald Trump. Ossoff has tried to walk a line between liberals looking for a chance to oppose Trump and Republicans who might support him. On MSNBC, host Chris Matthews asked Ossoff what he thought of Trump.
Well, it was one of the most divisive and destructive presidential races in U.S. history. And I think that many have been hoping that the president will heal some of those wounds, show good faith, and a more inclusive approach to governance. So far, I don't think that he's allayed those concerns.
Donald Trump took to Twitter this morning declaring Ossoff would be a disaster in Congress and urging Republicans in the district to get out and vote. The White House says it's committed to transparency amid criticism of the decision to keep visitor records secret and new calls for Donald Trump to release his federal tax returns. Government watchdog groups argue Trump is preventing the public from learning basic details about his financial ties and blocking information about the groups and individuals trying to influence the White House. Thousands of protesters marched across the country Saturday demanding Trump release his tax returns. But White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer maintained at yesterday's press briefing that Trump was unable to make the information public because he's under audit, despite the fact tax experts say an audit would not prevent him from releasing his returns. A reporter asked Spicer about the issue.
On the tax question, you've been asked about this obviously a thousand times.
Thank you.
You always talk about, well, under audit, the president says under audit. Is it time just to say once and for all the president is never going to release his tax returns?
We'll have to get back to you on that.
If you want, I mean, really.
Really?
So he may.
No, I said I'd have to get back to you on that. I think that he is still under audit. The statement still stands.
Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton was asked about the issue at a rowdy town hall meeting. The crowd booed Cotton when he repeated the statement that Trump's taxes are under audit.
You in Congress and in the Senate have the power to subpoena these tax returns. The president said during the campaign that he would not release the tax returns while it was under audit. Now he says the election has happened and he doesn't need to release his tax returns. I'm wondering if you'll take the initiative to have him release those returns so that we can see what kinds of connections he has with different countries around the world and what would you like to say?
In a surprise announcement, British Prime Minister Theresa May has called for an early general election to be held June 8th. To seek a strong mandate as she negotiates Britain's exit from the European Union.
It was with reluctance that I decided the country needs this election. But it is with strong conviction that I say it is necessary to secure the strong and stable leadership the country needs to see us through Brexit and beyond.
May's governing Conservative Party currently has a small majority with 330 seats in the 650-seat House of Commons. May is hoping that with the opposition Labour Party divided, the Conservatives will pick up an expanded majority. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are going to be continuing our series on immigration, in particular, Know Your Rights, on as it relates to immigration. We're going to be focusing on sanctuary cities across the country, including in Southern California, as well as nationally. And the Trump administration is seeking changes in the visa program. It is being reported that it will discourage the hiring of low-wage foreign workers, according to the New York Times. And of course, this is related to the H-1B visas. Meanwhile, Los Angeles is responding to the Trump travel ban, as reported in the Los Angeles Times, by the Department of Tourism launching an advertising campaign with, quote, "Everyone is welcome." Well, let me welcome our guest, Emily Robinson, who is the co-director, clinical attorney of the Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic of Loyola Law School. Emily, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Today, we're going to be focusing in our series here on sanctuary and the state of sanctuary cities. Explain to our audience what a sanctuary city means.
So it's a little difficult because there is no formal definition of a sanctuary city. Some cities do have their own laws in place. States do as well, that have kind of formed this definition for their individual jurisdictions. But the sentiment of a sanctuary city is more or less to not allocate state resources for the enforcement of immigration. Essentially, we have a separation of state and federal powers and jurisdictions, and it's important to ensure that states have autonomy in protecting their citizens and enforcing their local laws. So when we talk about sanctuary, it can mean many different things. I know that here I practice in California, and with SB 54, we've been looking into just limiting information sharing, basically putting a prohibition on offering up certain pieces of information to allocate state resources for federal immigration enforcement.
Right. And to just set part of the context of this discussion here, we do have our clip ready now. Jeff Sessions was at the U.S.-Mexico border, and chilling words from him. And of course, in immigrant communities across the United States, there's a lot of fear. Let us hear from Jefferson Sessions, who has had a history of racism. Coretta Scott King actually spoke out, wrote a letter against him being appointed as a federal judge some decades ago, and that letter was not allowed to be read on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Elizabeth Warren, who read the letter, was censored. Quite a history there. Jefferson Sessions, let's hear what he had to say.
Criminal aliens and the coyotes and the document forgers seek to overthrow our lawful system of immigration. So let's stop here for a moment. When we talk about MS-13 and the cartels, what do we mean? We mean international criminal organizations that turn cities and suburbs into war zones, that rape and kill innocent civilians, and who profit by smuggling poison and other human beings across our borders. Depravity and violence are their calling cards, including brutal machete attacks, even beheadings. They threaten the very integrity of our nations in our hemisphere. It is here on this sliver of land, on this border, where we first take our stand. It is a direct threat to our legal system and to our peace and prosperity.
So the U.S. Attorney General basically issuing what is policy of the Trump administration on the U.S.-Mexico border. And let us now return to our guest, co-director, clinical attorney, Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic of Loyola Law School, Emily Robinson. Emily, in hearing those words, you know, one could well understand the fear and concern in immigrant communities, but also the kind of whipping up of fear that immigrants somehow are these horrible, violent people, although the statistics show that that is indeed not the case. So that means that there is an increasing need, I think, of sanctuary in terms of churches or as well as cities. For example, let's use Los Angeles as an example, implementing sanctuary in Los Angeles. And what would that mean for people who want to seek sanctuary?
Well, so there are a few different things in play in Los Angeles right now. A lot of religious entities have kind of started a movement to offer up safe spaces. Unfortunately, there is no way for a church or any other institution to truly keep federal immigration enforcement from doing their job if they do have a judicially executed warrant for an individual. But I think what goes
so that means that they can enter a church, right? I mean, immigration authorities can enter a church, even though, let's say, the priest minister of that church says no, they have a right to enter if they've got a warrant.
Exactly. If they have a judicially executed warrant, I think the issue is that a lot of immigration officials, ICE agents, will appear at private spaces with a document that they claim is an immigrant, but is actually is a warrant for the search and seizure of an immigrant, but it's actually an ICE internal executed document that does have the person's name, perhaps their address, perhaps their photo, but it's not a judicially executed warrant. And that distinction is causing a lot of confusion for safe spaces for immigrants. And so there is a right of private spaces to keep out immigration officials if they do not have a warrant executed by a judge specifically seeking the location of an individual who is present in that space.
Given that, what are the advantages of sanctuary cities for immigrant communities or even sanctuary churches?
I think the benefit is creating a sense of trust in the community. At this point, you know, we've heard of immigrants being seized in courthouses seeking restraining orders. We've heard of immigration officials coming into dependency courts. The father who was arrested taking his child to school, this impacts public health. It impacts education and safety. And if we don't have state and local entities sticking up for their community members, it hurts all of us. And I think that there is value in the sense that there are rights to keep immigration officials out of private spaces. And there is no way for the federal government to circumvent the separation of state and federal powers. We do have the 10th Amendment. So I think that these moves by state and city jurisdictions are crucial. And a lot of this information is very sensitive. If you think about, for example, here in California, we have driver's licenses for undocumented individuals. You had to indicate on that application that you were undocumented in order to obtain that driver's license. If we're not doing things like the SB 54 provision here in California to basically limit the sharing of information, then anyone who applied for these driver's licenses has their information accessible as well as their home address. And so this will make people move, cause them to not leave homes, and all of this is very unhealthy and very scary for the immigrant community.
Also, what about how do protections as an immigrant differ depending on what country you live in? Is there any difference there in terms of how the ICE officers deal with you?
In terms of your constitutional rights, here in this country, there is no difference between an American citizen and an individual who is from another country. Our Constitution does not apportion rights based on your country of origin. So while immigration officials may violate individuals' constitutional rights, by being a national of another country alone, your rights are not degraded.
Yeah. And now what about this threat by the Trump administration against sanctuary cities, saying that they could lose millions in federal grant dollars if they remain a sanctuary city? How are, you know, as far as you know, what has been the response to that threat?
I think that it has had a chilling effect on cities. I think that's why Los Angeles took some time to kind of develop policies, think about where they wanted to allocate resources and the protection of their individuals residing in the state who are undocumented. It's a big deal. We have funding that for programs like education and health, and this not only impacts our undocumented community, but a lot of indigent communities and communities needing essential services. So it's not when these threats are made, it's not a decision to become a sanctuary city that can be made without a lot of thoughtfulness and structure and policy. And I think on the part of California, a lot of consulting with counsel, thinking about whether or not any policies do violate 1373. Are we going to actually violate federal law, or are we working within the rights as the 10th Amendment provide us for separation of state and federal powers? And I know that in California, there has been a lot of thought around this because there's so much need for federal funding. However, you can't just strip states of federal funding when these provisions and limitations were not indicated in the initial granting of federal funds. And I think that's going to be a big legal debate that we're going to see coming down the pipeline.
Right. And for people who want to get more information about sanctuary, they're just to become better informed, what should they do? I know that some people, and there's been a call too for individual people to house or provide sanctuary to the degree that they can, and even individual homes. I don't know if you can say anything about that, but for people who do want to find out more, what should they do?
Well, for us here at the Immigrant Justice Clinic, we are at Dolores Mission Church every Wednesday from 2:30 to 5, giving free consultations so that people know their rights and whether or not they can access immigration relief. We also do that at Homeboy Industries on Friday from 2 to 5. and individuals can call and make appointments with us. It doesn't matter their immigration issue. Of course, it does have to be an immigration legal issue. A lot of local nonprofits also have open intake days. I know that Caresen is another local nonprofit that can be called. Chirla also has opportunities for intake. I do encourage anyone who is undocumented or concerned about the immigration status of themselves or their family members to seek a legal consultation so they understand not only their rights when encountering immigration officials, but also do they have the opportunity to apply for anything or have legal relief. And if they can, we should start taking steps in that direction. In terms of rights of churches, we do have coalitions, immigrant integration task forces. I think that any religious affiliation should contact different organizing bodies. I know each religion kind of has their own organizing tables, but there have been conversations about their rights and how they can work together, how they can extend protections to community members who also want to open their homes for sanctuary. So I think the first step for any individual community member would be to speak to someone in their church, try to get more information, and for churches themselves to contact the networks that they meet in with other religious officials to think about aligned policies as there is strength in numbers and consistency in policies. I think that's really important for us to have definition and not just be acting without real thought behind this kind of sanctuary concept. But most importantly, people need to keep listening to programs like this, knowing their rights, not letting immigration officials in their home. It's very important to, once you open the door, to understand that immigration officials can question everyone in a home. So knowing your rights, attending Know Your Rights presentations couldn't be more important right now.
Right. Well, Emily Robinson, we know also that for our listeners in other cities, they could certainly get in touch with ACLU, the local immigrants rights organizations, the National Lawyers Guild, to get more information on sanctuary and about Know Your Rights. Emily Robinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All righty. And we are going to be continuing our series with the Loyola Immigrant Justice Clinic. But now we are going to turn our attention to what is happening now in Israeli prisons. On Monday, to mark Palestinian Prisoners Day, more than 1,000 incarcerated Palestinians started a hunger strike, demanding basic rights and more humane treatment in their Israeli jails. This year marks 50 years since the Six-Day War, when Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory began, and over those 50 years, more than 800,000 Palestinians have been detained under Israeli military orders in occupied territory. That's as much as 40% of the total male Palestinian population. And since the year 2000, 8,000 Palestinian children have been arrested as well. This, according to the human rights group Ademir. And because Israel has built nearly all of its prisons, 16 of 17 inside Israel, rather than in occupied territory, it has arrested those thousands of Palestinians in occupied territory and forcibly transferred them into captivity in Israel. This makes it extremely difficult for family members to cross into Israel and visit their incarcerated loved ones. The hunger strikers are fighting for better visitation rights, as well as better access to medical care, allowing women prisoners to be allowed to hold their children, installing phones to let prisoners talk to their families, and stopping the use of isolation and more. Now, this strike was initiated by Barwan Bergati, a Palestinian movement leader who spent the last 15 years in an Israeli prison. Now, at the time that we go on air, we have learned that Barwan Bergati has been placed in solitary confinement, in isolation, by the Israeli authorities. Now, Palestinians have suffered torture, inhumane and degrading treatment, and medical negligence. 200 prisoners have died because of these actions, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Club. And yesterday, people in the occupied cities of Ramallah, Hebron, and Nablus held solidarity rallies to support the prisoners. But Israel is already trying to put down this movement. And the throwing of Marwan into solitary confinement is part of that. And the Israeli Minister of Public Security said the country will not negotiate with prisoners. He calls them terrorists and incarcerated murderers. Well, here to discuss all of this with us, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Hank Jones. Hank was one of eight former members and supporters of the Black Panther Party, arrested January 23, 2007, on unproven charges, still to this day unproven, to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officers. Now, charges made were thrown out when a judge found that defendants made confessions after police in New Orleans tortured them for several days. And Hank Jones has been all through it, and he's also been to Palestine and is active in his support for the people of Palestine. Hank Jones, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
Hank, tell us first about when did you go to Palestine, and what do you think you got out of that particular trip?
Okay, we went to, I was part of a 19-member prisoner, labor, academic solidarity delegation to Palestine that we went to Palestine last year in March 24th. And we spent 10 days over there, you know, two of the occupied territories, the so-called 48 that was where Palestinians were forced off the land in 1948, and then it was occupied in 1967 by Israeli colonialists. And what I got out of it, what I went there for, was to show support and solidarity with Palestinian political prisoners. And what I got out of it was just to observe the systems of repression that are used against unoccupied people, militarily occupied people, the Palestinian people, and witnessing their steadfastness in spite of all of this. It was inspiring to me. They have, in many ways, you know, the same situation that the South African people were victimized under. And I related also to the racist conditions in the southern United States. And I think that just witnessing their continued struggle for basic human rights and dignity and respect, where they have absolutely no recourse, actually, and which results in this mass incarceration.
Yeah, and Hank, I mean, from what you learned and heard from the Palestinian people, I guess there is no surprise about this hunger strike that is now going on. And more than 1,000 Palestinians have gone on this hunger strike. And now Marwan Barghouti, one of the hunger strike leaders, has been placed in solitary confinement. Hank, when people think of torture and abuse inside prisons, even those who may be surprised about that going on in Israeli prisons, but also may not know about the fact that it also happens within U.S. prisons. And I wanted to kind of contrast that a little bit in terms of the conditions being faced inside U.S. prisons of abuse.
Yes. You know, many people are unaware that there are political prisoners being held in the United States. There are some over 100, actually. And some of them are former Black Panther Party members. There are like 12 former Black Panther Party members still being held from the 1960s. 1969 is when Romain Chip Fitzgerald, who is a former Los Angeles Black Panther Party member, was incarcerated, and he's going on now 50 years, you know, in prison.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And being held as a political prisoner and not being, you know, paroled or released because of his political beliefs. Many people are familiar with Mumia Abu-Jamal, Mutulu Shakur, and you know, Sundiata Akali, and you know, but there are, like I say, about 12 former victims of COINTELPRO operations who are still being held in the United States. And when I went to Palestine, I wanted to make a connection between our political prisoners and theirs. And we visited many former political prisoners. We visited families of martyrs. We visited people doing prison abolition work and activists around political prisoners, and spent a lot of time. And that was our primary focus in going to Palestine, was the political prisoner issue.
You were saying you got to hear firsthand. I mean, in talking with some of the former prisoners, for example, were you able to kind of compare notes a little bit, find out about what the conditions were inside the Israeli prisoners? Because among other things, it's very, very difficult for family members to visit, right?
Yeah.
Given all of the laws there. Yeah.
Absolutely. They make it very difficult, if at all. And that's part of the, you know, torture of prisoners is sanctioned by the Israeli government because they consider they label their political prisoners as terrorists. So it's an occupied, military occupied situation there. Palestinians are tried in military tribunals and not civilian courts. You know, and they incarcerate men, women, and children. The youngest, I think, was like 12 years old.
Mm.
And there are no juvenile prisons. They are all locked up in the same prisons.
Wow. So, yeah. And you mentioned torture. And Marwan Bhagati, I just want to share a quote from him about the inhumane treatment he received as a teenager. He said, "I was only 15 when I was first imprisoned. I was barely 18 when an Israeli interrogator forced me to spread my legs while I stood naked in the interrogation room before hitting my genitals. I passed out from the pain, and the resulting fall left an everlasting scar on my forehead. The interrogator mocked me afterwards, saying that I would never procreate because people like me give birth only to terrorists and murderers." I mean, this is just one example is torture, which, as you say, is perfectly legal in Israeli prisons. Now, although it's not supposed to be happening in U.S. prisons, we certainly know it does go on. We covered here on Sojourner Truth the case of the Dallas Six in Pennsylvania, and they were men who had witnessed torture inside a prison there in Berks. The name of the prison was Dallas, and they reported it. And as a peaceful protest, they put sheets over the bars and inside the prison. The guards came in and beat the hell out of them and then turned around and charged them with torture. So they were able, after 7 years, to finally, you know, get rid of that riot charge. But Hank, what about the torture that happens inside U.S. prisons?
Yes, you know, it's not unusual for prison guards to punish, you know, inmates by beatings and tortures and putting them in severe restraint positions and things like this. That's kind of a common practice, and as well as throwing you in solitary confinement. I'm a former political prisoner. You know, back in the 70s, I was incarcerated. One of the times I was incarcerated, I witnessed a lot of this kind of thing. What goes on in our prisons, and the reasons that we feel prisons are inhumane and violations of international law and need to be abolished, is because there are no controls over what goes on inside the prisons. No one's overseeing this stuff. And what they're doing is abusing the inmates. And this goes on in Palestine as well. And they have no recourse, as I say, because the laws are all stacked against them. You go to a military tribunal there, 99.7% of all Palestinians who go through these tribunals are convicted.
Mm.
And we witnessed, we visited one of the military prisons and witnessed three tribunals. One was a young man of 16 years old, who was a young boy who was 16 years old, who was accused of trying to run over a guard, I mean, a military guard. There was no evidence other than he didn't have a defense. He wasn't able to present a defense. The evidence against him was a mock-up video reenactment of the crime he was accused of. And he was facing two life sentences. You know, that kind of stuff is a form of torture in a way. So, like I say, there's no recourse. So you end up with 7,000 political prisoners, and I think one in five Palestinians has been a political prisoner or is.
Wow, one in five.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of this conditions people don't know about. And of course, the history of hunger strikes in U.S. prisons, as well as in political prisoners in Ireland as well. And now we're seeing the hunger strike, that tactic being used in immigration detention centers. Yeah. So we're going to be...
It's a peaceful means of protest. It doesn't harm anyone other than the hunger striker, you know, but it does send a powerful message, especially when you have like 2,000, 3,000. In 2013, we had a hunger strike here in the United States, a prison hunger strike. Over 3,000 inmates participated, and there was a solidarity protest in Palestine for that hunger strike. So. We have to.
There was a solidarity protest in Palestine for the California prisoner hunger strike. Did you say, Hank?
Yeah, they were in solidarity with that hunger strike.
Right. And so for people who are, you know, who are listening here, I know that you were part of an event that happened at UCLA yesterday evening. Was there any discussion about what people could do here in terms of showing a solidarity or drawing out the conditions that the Palestinian prisoners are facing?
The tool that left to... to colonize the Palestinian people are limited, but what you see in the prisons is the hunger strike. That's one means of protest, but then There's the BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions Movement. It's an international movement where you can withhold support. It's for the racist, colonialist, Zionist regime. So you can withhold your support by engaging in this boycott, divest, and sanctions movement. It's similar to what we used in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Was successful there, and it's successful. It's being successful here in this case in Palestine. But of course, the colonialist regimes, they are passing laws to try to criminalize even boycotting. And one of the Israeli, while we were there, one of the Israeli Knesset members openly called for the assassination of the head of the BDS movement. Boycott, sanctions.
Yeah. And we know that that movement is growing and having some success. Hank Jones, we're going to have to leave it there, take a short station break, and then we go on to our Africa Rising series. But Hank Jones, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret. Have a good one.
Okay, we'll be right back. We're going to be continuing our Africa Arises series in the lead up to African Liberation Day. We'll be talking about this emerging movement on the continent of Africa. Our guest is Amira Woods. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm gonna make a change. For once in my life.
Already the late, great Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror. This is Margaret Prescott. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth, and we are heard across the nation and worldwide on the web. And you can check us out anytime 24/7 at www.sotrueradio.org. You could hear today's show, and also all of our back shows are archived there. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the great nation of Senegal. And we now turn our attention to our series on Africa Rising Beyond Borders. Now, African Liberation Day is coming up on May 25th, and there is preparations going on the continent, but also here in the United States across the diaspora for that. And some key events are going to be taking place. But what I'd like to do is welcome back to Sojourner Truth Amira Woods. She's actually sitting in for us today because we had problems reaching our guest on the continent. So Amira, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and an expert on U.S. foreign policy with an emphasis, special emphasis on Africa and the developing world. Welcome back, Amira. Thank you.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you for focusing in on Gore Island, on Africans Rising, and thank you for all you do.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for filling in today. We had trouble, you know what, with... yes, and we will have Kumba Touré on another time. Where is Kumba based? She was to be our guest today.
Kumba is based in Dakar, Senegal.
Okay.
I was with her a few days ago.
Right.
And she is an extraordinary woman. She is the regional representative of Ashoka for West Africa. She is a writer of storybooks and a feminist. An artist.
Yeah.
She does a
well,
lot.
We certainly.
So I hope you have her on.
Yeah.
She is also an ambassador with Africans Rising and very much a part of this Pan-African movement that is linking social movements, civil society, trade unions, youth organizations, environmental justice activists on a common platform to stand for our peace, justice, dignity platform, and she's a part of this movement towards Launch Day, which is Africa Liberation Day, Thursday, May 25th, all around the continent and in the diaspora. And she is spearheading really a work around a launch at Goree Island for Africans Rising. So I hope you'll have her on at another time, and I'm happy to step in and talk with you and your listeners today.
Right, and it's interesting that for the launch of this, because from what I understand, Africa Rising, they really want a unity in Africa. Is that right?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
This is a Pan-Africanist division, right? One
yeah.
that was started with Kwame Nkrumah. You know, there's a long line of Pan-Africanists that goes back to Marcus Garvey, really, right?
Yeah.
That understood that with unity, there's strength. And so there have been many efforts to host Pan-African conferences. You know, there have been six that have been officially held, a seventh. The most recent in Tanzania, other efforts to hold them in other parts of the continent have taken place. But this goes beyond just a conference and a gathering. This is a linking, a platform of movements on the continent, the social movements that are bringing such vibrant energy and dynamism to the continent, but also a critical lens on a neoliberal economy that has failed for much of the continent, a critical lens on the environmental catastrophe that has the continent at its epicenter, right? So, you know, so this is taking forward a Pan-Africanist banner in a new time and era, and very much anchored in a critical tradition.
Yeah. Now, Amira, the concept of Pan-Africanism, popular, you know, back in the day. And of course, we had great leaders, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo assassinated, Julius Nyerere of Tanzania. You know, so it's just, you know, but also I have found that in the U.S., for example, there used to be a lot more concern about Pan-Africanism and people of African descent on the continent and in the diaspora. But today, and I've had this discussion, I raised it, I've heard Angela Davis and others talk about it, that when Black people in the United States became African Americans, a kind of you became American as opposed to all of us are Black together, and a kind of a nationalism set in. And there was the movement for Pan-Africanism didn't really get much of a look in. So this effort is part of trying to revive that kind of Pan-Africanist vision on the continent, but also involving people of African descent in the diaspora. Amira, what do you think?
Without a doubt, Margaret, this is the beauty of this movement. It is not only linking those on the continent, but also linking the diaspora throughout the world. And I think, you know, that critical piece of that you mentioned from Angela Davis, I think it's important for us to acknowledge that, and also acknowledge the changes that are underway with Black Lives Matter and these movements that are putting us as Africans in a collective sense front and center here in the U.S. understanding our critical agency as a people. And demanding that human rights, particularly for those for communities of color that are at the brink of an economic catastrophe, here in this country, workers being denied their basic rights and understanding the importance of linking hands, standing in solidarity to demand an economy that works for all in the state of, you know, this presidency that we currently are experiencing today.
Yeah.
So I think there is a new urgency for a Pan-Africanist movement, really. And I think it is the leaders of movements like Black Lives Matter, like the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, looking at questions of immigrant rights in this country and looking at the disproportionate impact of, you know, whether it's the executive orders or the immigration ban on Black, you know, immigrants to this country, and holding up a Pan-Africanist struggle as they push forward for rights right here in America as well. So I see this as kind of a new urgency, but carrying forward a battle that has been waged for really quite some time now, a battle for justice, for dignity and for rights.
Well, we really just have a minute. And just on this issue of African unity, I remember a story I heard from Selma James, the widow of C.L.R. James, a lot of in the independence movement, a lot of those leaders passed through their home in London. And they tell the story of a conversation between Roosevelt and Churchill. And they were discussing the question of post-war, Roosevelt, I guess, Churchill was asking Roosevelt, well, what are we going to do about all of these countries now on the continent and elsewhere? They're going to be coming demanding freedom and an end to colonialism. And Roosevelt said, give them a flag and a national anthem. Right. And I think that approach of really carving up Africa and, you know, supporting corrupt leadership is really part of what this Africa Rising movement is about and trying to deal with. Just a quick
Absolutely.
Final comment.
Yes, absolutely. This is it's people, it's young people especially, it's culture workers, musicians, artists, poets, standing up to demand rights, to demand the basic right. We must choose our leaders freely and then hold those leaders accountable. You know, that is the demand that your listeners will hear when you interview Mohamed Lamine Sidakan, from one of the leaders from the Gambia.
And we'll be talking with him on Thursday.
On Thursday,
coming up.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Part of the Movement for Change. And also part of Africans Rising and in the leadership of Africans Rising today. It is those vibrant voices and activists and leaders that I think are giving us new hope, right, for not only a united Pan-African tradition, but one that is going to really confront all the issues around legitimate leaders, whether they're in those who were formerly in the Gambia or those who are right here in Washington,
right,
D.C., where I am.
Okay. On that note, we have to leave it there. We are out of time. And thank you, Amira Woods. And we'll be continuing this series. We'll be talking more in depth about what has been going on in the Gambia with Africa Youth and more with Mohamed Lamine Sidakan on this coming Thursday. Thank you, Amira.
Thank you and all your listeners.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our intern, Sherelle Withers, assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and of course, Kiana Turner, our engineer for today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.